in the parchment.
I think just to start a little bit about the professor. He teaches social research at the university, and he has done research in social epistemology, which is basically the study of the interpretation of human knowledge being a collective achievement. And he's also done work on transhumanism, which is a movement dedicated to enhancing human intellectual, physical, and psychological capacities through the development of new technology. We're incredibly fortunate to have him here today with us to talk about his work and his views on transhumanism. So without further ado, please give a warm welcome to Professor Siegel.
Thank you very much, and thanks to Prashant for inviting me. We met because recently we had a 50th anniversary of Warwick University, and there was a festival, and he showed up to several events that took place there. And one of the events, which we ran during the whole period of this thing, which took place over a weekend, was to ask younger people, people your age, and in some cases even younger, about what their conception of the future was. Okay, and so this was the context in which we met. We're sort of at an interesting stage, you might say, in the development of humanity. Okay, the field that I'm officially in, you know, the department that I'm in at the University of Warwick, I need to contact me. I put my email address up here because if you want to contact me about so s.w.fuller@warwick.ac.uk. You know, this idea of sociology, the term was actually originally invented to talk about the ways in which various developments in the sciences, and when we say the sciences in this context, we mean not just the natural sciences and engineering and medicine and things like that, but also any kind of systematic body of knowledge. That includes the humanities and the social sciences. So if you guys have studied, you know, political science or economics or geography, right, or even English and philosophy and history, all of these fields that there's been kind of systematic knowledge developed about over the centuries, right? The idea of sociology originally was to bring all this knowledge together to expedite the progress of humanity. In other words, to enable us to develop faster and to go as far as we possibly can. Okay, that was the original idea of sociology. Sociology since that time has moved in many different directions. But I do think that, in a sense, what I'm talking about here today goes very much to what sociology was originally about, which was about advancing the human condition. And so there's an interesting question about what that means. What does it mean to advance the human condition? And nowadays, we often talk about this in terms of enhancement. And maybe, let me just put it this way, enhancement. I don't know if you've run across this phrase, but very often this has to do with ways in which we might actually increase or improve our physical and mental capabilities from the way they are normally biological. Okay. So, for example, conditions under which this happens can be quite interesting and important in a way, because sometimes there are forms of enhancement that, in a sense, are developed to cure disabilities, which in fact then give additional powers to people. And if you think about somebody like Oscar Pistorius, right, and this kind of thing, you know, in terms of what the sort of legs and feet that he had, and the sorts of powers that this enabled him to have. But also think about somebody like Stephen Hawking, if you're familiar with Stephen Hawking, the physicist, who is for all intents and purposes a quadriplegic, right? That is a person who cannot move. Cannot move his legs and arms, but cannot actually move most of the muscles in his body, right? And nevertheless, he has all of this kind of machinery surrounding him, a kind of enhanced wheelchair, as it were, that enables him actually to retain his status as one of the great scientists of the world. Okay? And in a way, these are very extreme cases. But of course, in other ways, we've been enhancing the human condition for a very long time. Okay, if you keep in mind the fact that from a strictly evolutionary standpoint, if you believe in biological evolution, the brain's developed, the way the brain, the, brain you're born with is pretty much the brain that people 40,000 years ago were born with. But what's happened in the interim is that there are lots of ways of changing it over the course of your life. Diet, right, for example, the various kinds of things that we eat and drink, you know, drugs, various the ways you're exposed to the environment. The brain, as we continue to learn, is a much more plastic thing than perhaps people thought, let's say, when I was your age. So in other words, there's lots of changes that the environment and various things that we put into our bodies can end up doing in affecting our brains. And it, to a large extent, what they have done is to enhance our capacities in many ways, not only in terms of our capacities for thought, but also our capacities to do things. And of course, this is applied to our bodies as well. And as you know, probably, that life expectancy of people, you know, from 40,000 years ago has kind of not only tripled, maybe quadrupled from that time. And, you know, to give you a sense of where we are at the moment, if you think about the retirement age of 65, right, which is something you may have run across, there is a retirement age of 65 in most cultures. That number was actually figured out in 1890 at a time when people were expected to live to be 62. Right, in other words, the number of people who you'd actually have to pay any pension to would be less than half the population. So from the standpoint of the state, you know, getting taxes and so forth, this was a kind of fundable proposition. But then what happens in the situation that we live in now, where people are now living easily 20 years beyond retirement age? How do we fund the pensions under those circumstances? Okay? And so this is one of the kind of practical issues where people start to get interested very much on the idea of enhancing human beings generally, not only as something that just sort of happens over history, but it's something that we might want to do deliberately. Okay? So for example, again, I don't know how much you pay attention to the news, but there is a lot of discussion about the possibility of raising the retirement age. Right? So old people don't have to pull a pension so early that they can work longer. Well, how is that going to be possible? Well, people will have to be healthier for a longer period of time. Because at the moment, you can retire at 65, and you can live another 20 years, and you can be a complete wreck, and as a result, be in the hospital all the time. And that wastes a lot of money. Right? I mean, I think you understand what I'm talking about. Because the people who pick up the tab for this are you guys. You guys are going to enter into the job market, right, at some point, and pay taxes. You're the people who, in fact, are paying for the pensions of people who live an enormously long period of time, right, without actually being very healthy or anything like that. And this is a real ongoing social, we might say, intergenerational crisis that is emerging between younger people who are entering the job market and the older people who are able to retire at the normal retirement age but yet live unhealthy lives for a long period. Okay? The reason why I mention this is because this is one very practical, very politically important issue that I think you guys are going to be facing in the coming years about why it's important to think about an enhanced human condition. And one of the reasons is going to be because you want people to be productive longer. That is one of the bottom line notions. So regardless of what other notions you have, the fact is that it may be that there's a lot more productivity in people than you give them credit for. I'll give you an example. Okay, so I am 56 years old. Okay? I'm 56 years old. I am less than 10 years away from retirement. Okay? Now that should be a scary thought to you people. Right? Because you wouldn't want somebody like me to retire so early. Okay? And I do think that in a sense we should start thinking that way. So that's one of the practical political motivations that's involved in actually trying to get people to live longer, healthier lives, and so forth. And this involves an enormous amount of change about people's lives, right? Because you think about it. At the moment, we actually organize our societies around people being born in a certain period, going to school for a certain number of years, maybe going to university, getting a job, working for a certain number of years, retiring, right? There's a life cycle that's kind of generally recognized within society. Certain time when you have children, right? All this kind of stuff. Now, the question is, this is being very seriously disturbed at the moment because there is the possibility that people could live much longer and live much healthier lives. And so we would have to think about how society would need to be reorganized under the circumstances. Okay? So this is the kind of issue that I think you people who are coming into the world now and going to become the future leaders in the next 20 or 30 years are going to have to face in a very direct kind of way. So that's kind of, you might say, the practical political context in which this issue matters. But now, what are the options on the table? Okay? And it was mentioned in the beginning, when I was introduced, that I've been working a lot on this thing called transhumanism. Okay? Now, transhumanism should be understood in a sense as taking humanity to the next level. And the question becomes, what is this next level? You know, as I mentioned before, and I think we can sort of accept for the sake of argument, right, human beings are basically, in the first instance, in terms of how we came about into the world, upright apes. We are a certain kind of upright ape. Maybe other things about us. We may have a soul, we may have consciousness, we may have minds that are, you know, qualitatively different from other apes, all that, but, you know, that's fine. But we basically are in that form, right? And we have a lot of the same physical parameters as other apes in this regard. Now the question becomes, how significant is this fact? Right? Just because we began as apes, do we have to end up being apes? Okay? And now, you know, you might think, what is he talking about here? Well, the point is that when we move into something like transhumanism, there's a kind of open question about the platform, right, the medium in which what is most distinctive about humanity ought to be realized. We think about what distinguishes human beings from apes already, right? We might think about rationality, we might think about consciousness, right? There are all these qualities that people have that apes don't have. Language, perhaps, so that's, you know, a lot of these things are contestable, but of course, these are the things that come to your mind when you think about this. Well, what if it were possible for us to kind of migrate, right, to transfer ourselves into another form of embodiment that actually enables us to even be more human than we currently are? In other words, to be more rational, to be more conscious. In other words, to increase the distance between ourselves and apes. Okay? And transhumanism is about that kind of idea, basically. Okay? And there are two ways of thinking about this. One way of thinking about it actually keeps the biological body, our ape-like biological body, intact, but keeps it around indefinitely. In other words, the idea of living forever in the body of your own and never aging, never becoming decrepit or degraded or anything, but being able to live in a sort of, you know, permanent, whatever age you want, 30, 40, whatever you think is the age, and just stay there, because the sort of normal kind of degradation of genes that take place, and, you know, the genes produce, enable ourselves to reproduce on a regular basis, and the way we age is about that process kind of degrading over time. And we make copies of copies of copies. And so the thing is, what if we could stop that process so that you could remain as you are in the peak of your powers forever? Now that's one form of transhumanism, okay? And that involves you staying within the biological body of your birth, but living this immortal existence. That's one possibility. And you know, people, there's lots of money being spent on research to reverse and arrest the aging process with this kind of idea in mind. And even they're very radical people around. And you know, those of you who take an interest in this might maybe know about this already, I don't know. Have any of you heard of cryonics? Some of you have. Okay, good. Okay, well, so cryonics, right, as soon as you die, you get put into the deep freeze to a point where whatever disease you died for or from or whatever, you know, gets cured, and you can be effectively resurrected
in a form that will enable you to live indefinitely. Right?
So, the big mecca for cryonics in the United States is called Alcor in Arizona, right? And rich people, typically, because you've got to pay a lot of money to do this, right, basically have a kind of contract that as soon as they die, within a certain number of minutes or something, someone will be putting them in deep freeze, shipping them over there, right? And as long as this happens within a short enough period of time, right, there isn't so much decay of the body from death, so there is, at least in theory, a possibility that you could be resurrected. Okay? That's one kind of view of transhumanism. Now, the other view, which is also very prominent, and you may have heard of this one as well, is the idea, the way it's often put, that we upload our consciousness. Right? That there's a sense in which, we began as apes, but this ape-like body in which we operate is pretty inefficient. It has all kinds of inherent limitations built into it, right? I mean, in other words, if you really want to run fast, you want to do something, you really have to enhance yourself so much that maybe the best thing to do would be to just transfer it to another form. Okay? And so the idea of uploading consciousness, right, where what is consciousness here? Consciousness would mean, in this context, some way of digitally recording your memories, your thoughts, right, being able to kind of map them in some kind of system that could then be transferred to a more durable silicon form. Right? And this silicon form may exist, on a little computer chip or something. It may look nothing like you from the standpoint of what you're used to thinking of yourself as looking at. But of course, it would give you the power to actually imagine yourself as you normally think about yourself. Right? So the chip would actually have the power for you to imagine the you normally think of yourself as being. Right? It has this virtualization capacity. So when we talk about uploading consciousness into machines, into silicon chips, into stuff like that, you shouldn't think about this in terms of, if this were possible, then God, what would it be like to be a chip? No, you wouldn't be you'd be thinking about yourself in the way you normally think about yourself, but you would no longer be embodied that way. Right? So it would be a kind of grand illusion in a sense, right? From the standpoint of somebody looking at you from the outside. But nevertheless, you would still have all of the powers that you had when you were in your biological body. Okay? Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that there's an enormous amount of research being done these days on artificial intelligence and actually trying to figure out what the relationship is between human intelligence and machine intelligence and to make these things work much more in synchrony with each other, right? So that in a sense, machines can understand humans, humans can understand machines, and they can kind of converge in the way in which they think. And so, that's kind of the state of the art at the moment. And with that, in the long term, one might imagine that there could be this kind of merger taking place, in principle at least. Okay? This opens up a lot of questions, of course, and a lot of issues. But let me point out one thing to you that might be of interest. Namely, that one of the big problems that we often hear about human beings is they live longer and they consume more and so forth in the normal bodies in which we operate. Is that there'll be too many of us, and we'll be too rich, and we'll end up depleting the planet entirely, right? There's already a problem with global warming. There's all kinds of forms of environmental degradation in society that cause from human waste and the way in which we get rid of other species and things like this. But what if it were possible to live what we regard as a human existence on a minimum energy resource? Right? So in other words, we don't actually have to take up all this carbon space. We don't need to leave enormous carbon footprints. What if it were possible to actually be able to live in a human way and really reduce our carbon requirements to such a large extent because we basically become embodied computers? You see, that would be one way, a very radical way of solving the environmental crisis. Would be to reduce the carbon footprint of human beings by reducing the degree to which we're carbon at all. Okay?
And so some people think that in the long term, this might be a kind of idea. All right. Now, the reason why I bring all this stuff up to you is because there is actually scientific research happening that, in a sense, corresponds to all of these trajectories. Okay? And on top of that, there are also ongoing social problems that we need to deal with now, which have to do with people living longer, but not necessarily more healthy lives, right? And also a growing population, which is clearly making a kind of strain on the environment as a whole. All of those issues are not science fiction. Those issues are already here. And the question is, what constitutes a long-term solution to them? And so the kind of answers that transhumanists put forward are ones where we take seriously the idea that we radically reconfigure the kind of being that we are. What does it mean to be a human being? Okay? Now, I'm mindful of the time. I think why don't I stop here and start taking some questions? Because I think that might be a good... Because I think I put enough on the table for you guys. And so, what you know, any issues that you want to raise. Because look, this is very radical stuff, but I think as, you know, you're young people, and new people are going to actually have to deal with this in more realistic forms in the future. It might seem very radical and science fictional now, but this stuff is going to come on the street. So what kinds of questions do you have? Yes, sir.
Is there an automatic assumption that we have to live longer? Because is there not like a method which would involve people living shorter lives but more fulfilled?
This is very good. This is a very good question. I personally do not believe that we have to always, that we need to focus on living forever. I mean, and there's an interesting sociological issue here. Namely that, a few points. One point is that as people live longer, they tend to have fewer children. This is well known already, okay? However, generational change is very often the primary means by which radical conceptual or political change occurs in society. In other words, having new people who don't have the memory of the past coming on the street is actually by itself a very important way in which change happens in society. And if we were to live in a world where people are living forever and are not motivated to have kids, because they figure, okay, I didn't succeed in the first 100 years of my life, now I've got the next 100 years where I can try. Right? All of those memories might turn out to be inhibiting for us. Right? Because people will always be thinking about the past, where they came from. And so, you're absolutely right. It is not at all obvious that living forever or living indefinitely is such a good thing. I mean, my view is, I think, that with transhumanism, what you should be getting is a more discretionary view about death. Right? In other words, if it is possible for you to live forever, then in a sense, maybe you should have the choice. Because I think one of the reasons why there's an enormous taboo surrounding death is because in some sense it's always seen as forced upon you. Right? Either by nature or by someone who kills you. Right? There's a sense in which it's involuntary. But it seems to me that one of the things that transhumanism allows is the possibility that one might think about death in a more discretionary way. Namely, I could be living forever, but just like when people decide to retire early, people may decide to die early. You see? And I think actually that would be the mark of a civilized society under the circumstances, especially if people want to keep in mind the value that comes from having new, young people on stream on a regular basis. So that's a very good point, actually. Yes, sir.
When you refer to living forever, do you mean in the sense that the human conscience will be able to live on forever? Do you mean that in our present state, in these bodies, there could be a time in the future where it is possible for some to live forever?
I mean, both possibilities are on the table. This is the thing, right? Some transhumanists actually are talking about your ability to live in your own body, the body you have right now, forever. The biological forever, okay? Other people who believe in uploading consciousness and stuff like that basically believe that what is you is not really your body. It's really just your consciousness. And as long as we can figure out a way of extracting that digitally and putting it into a computer that can go on forever, that's you forever. You see what I mean? They're two different notions. And they the difference turns on the extent to which the body, your body, is really needed for you to be who you are. And but they're both views on the table.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, say that again.
Our biological transhumanists focus on making sure that the current form is also they would like focus on like free radical theory and working with that to stop people dying of old age.
Yeah. Just so for example, some of this stuff gets hooked in with things like trying to deal with Alzheimer's and lots of diseases that are associated with old age. That in a way kind of kind of channel into this kind of general sensibility, right? The idea, because in a sense, we already live in a world where because of our normal diets and the way the environment is set up, that we actually can live quite a long time, but not necessarily in a great state. And so the idea is to be able to live not only a long time, but in a state that's not degraded. And so this is where the transhumanism thing will come in, you see. So things like Alzheimer's, all these diseases of old age, certain cancers, for example, right? This would be kind of the focus of the biomedical side of transhumanism. Sir, yes?
So why are
Good question, good question. There's a book I would recommend if you really want to follow this up, right? It's called Mind Clones. Okay? And it's by Martine Rothblatt. And this is an important issue from a legal standpoint, right? Because the issue of what your sphere of action is. So, here you are as a physical human being, but you also then create this other digital version of yourself that has a kind of second life existence, right? Is that just as much you as you and your physical body, okay? Because there might be issues of legal responsibility, especially if the digital version of you does something nasty, right? Which could happen, of course. And so are you liable for it in your physical body? I mean, one place where this kind of issue has arisen already, because so this issue already has some legal traction, okay? I'll give you an example. And this is from this country, actually, from the law of this country. About 5 years ago, there was a couple who met on Second Life. You know what Second Life is? You guys know what Second Life is? It's kind of virtual reality world that you can inhabit where you become these avatars, right? And you can create entire societies and economies, and it can get incredibly complicated. You can basically spend all of your time in this thing, and you basically project these avatars, these kind of alternative identities in cyberspace. Okay? Well, there are a couple of people who met in that capacity and got married in normal life as a result. Okay? They met as avatars, they got married in normal life. Now, what happens? Well, the avatar of the husband has an affair with an avatar in the second life. The wife, in this life, files for divorce. She won. She won, okay? This is the point, right? Mainly because the meaningful part of their relationship, by which they met and by which they really had some kind of occurred in the second life. Okay? And so from the judge's standpoint, the avatars were natural extensions of the original biological person. So even though the husband was saying, no, that's my avatar doing it, it's not me, nevertheless, the two were seen as the same from the standpoint of legal agency. Okay? So we may be going down this route, right? Where in a sense, yes, you can project yourself in many different forms, but you may be legally accountable for all of them.
Okay.